The following program for a blind and print-impaired audience is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm John Federson, and as usual, on this day of the week, which is a Friday at first at least, we will read from the Indie Week, the independent North Carolina Weekly Journal. The date of today's broadcast, August the 10th of 2023. And a couple of small articles before we get into a very long article from Orange County. But the Durham movie theater that bustled in the late aughts and kept life quietly thrumming in Northgate Mall long after the retail outlets around it went dark has shuttered, according to signs taped to its door that read, "Our time has come to end." Stadium 10, which was previously called Phoenix 10, launched in 2006, the first theater at that mall's Gregson Street entrance since 1985, when the mall's decades-old Twin Cinema was replaced with a department store. East Coast Entertainment, which owned and operated Stadium 10, was not able to be reached for comment. The company's phone number and website have been deactivated. That Stadium 10 faced tough odds in its final years. Northgate Mall closed permanently on the outset of the pandemic, leaving the theater to reopen as a solo enterprise in the secluded concrete plaza of a deserted shopping center. Northwood Investors, the firm that purchased the 55-acre Northgate Mall parcel in 2018, announced plans last year to transform most of the site into a life sciences research campus that presumably wouldn't include a movie theater. Northwood Investors didn't respond to the request for comment. The HVAC at Stadium 10 had also long been in disrepair, according to a host of online reviewers who described the theater as oscillating between two climates, sub-zero and sitting in an airplane before they turn the air on. At one sweltering three-hour Oppenheimer screening in July, the hottest month in recorded history, the staff provided viewers with cups of ice, a Reddit user disclosed, adding the experience was intense. Still, the closure makes for an abrupt goodbye. On July 31st, less than 24 hours before closed flyers appeared on its door, the Facebook page of Stadium 10 was inviting followers to buy Barbie tickets. Beloved buffet-style restaurant C&H Cafeteria, which opened the same week Stadium 10 did in August 2006 at the Shops at Northgate, similarly issued news of its closure in January via a taped-up sign the day of, crushing regulars, vegan restaurant Earth to Us, and Wyatt and Dad, a cobbler shop, also shut down their shops at Northgate in recent month, citing medical and staffing issues respectively. In February, Northwood Investors announced plans for the strip of shops to be renovated and left as retail. Neighbors from the nearby Walltown community have proposed alternative plans that use the Guest Road space for affordable housing, as well as local retail. All right, and moving directly over to Durham, two articles related to ones that I've read in the recent weeks. Preliminary test results confirm that areas of East Durham and Walltown are contaminated with lead. Contractors hired by the city of Durham have found hot spots of lead-contaminated soil in two parks, as well as the old sign and signal shop, prompting officials to fence off the affected areas no later than today. According to an update from the city published last night, these parks have lead above the EPA's action level of 400 parts per million for playgrounds. And these samples were taken at East Durham Park on East Main Street, Walltown neighborhood. They took 7 samples around Walltown on Guest Road, of course. 6 samples at the old sign and signal shop next to East End Park on North Alston. The shop is fenced in, not publicly accessible, though it's feasible that people could trespass there. Precise concentrations were not listed in the initial report, but they are expected to be included in the final version. All the neighborhoods where the parks contain lead are predominantly non-white, low-income, or both. Again, lead is a neurotoxin. Chronic exposure can cause permanent neurological and brain damage in children who are especially vulnerable because they spend time outdoors and often put their hands in their mouths. Adults with high blood levels of lead can suffer from brain, kidney, heart, and reproductive disorders. The contractor's sampling showed, quote, no potential contaminant concerns were found in samples taken from playgrounds at any of the parks, and none of the samples taken at Lion Park or Northgate exceeded that action level, according to initial results. Based on the findings, preliminary, the city is fencing off areas in the park where lead was detected above the action level and install signs to mark the area and provide educational and health resources. The city hired a firm, Mid-Atlantic Associates, to independently sample soil after Duke University researchers found high lead levels in some areas. In the fall of 2021, with Park and Rec's approval, Eniko Bihari, then a master's student at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment, sampled soil at three parks because the city had operated incinerators there until about 1850. Excuse me. Until 1950, when they were torn down. Old incinerator sites often are contaminated because the nature of the waste that was burned. There were no regulations at the time restricting the types of material. Because of time constraints, the researchers didn't test Lion Park, and Northgate Park was added for Mid-Atlantic sampling because historical documents showed incinerator ash had been dumped there. However, top city parks officials inexplicably withheld that information from the public. As early as November of 2022, Dari Richter, a Duke soil scientist and faculty advisor to that graduate student testing, alerted two top city parks officials, Tom Dawson and Robert Jennings, about the findings we previously reported. Richter contacted them again throughout the spring of this year with increasing levels of urgency, emails show, but neither Dawson nor Jennings informed the public, city council, or city manager. Only in June, after a resident of Walltown found the Duke graduate's thesis and its findings online, did Durham Parks officials acknowledge they knew about the study. Yet behind the scenes, Park Director Wade Walcott was pressuring Toddy Steelman, the dean of Duke's School of the Environment, to sit on the information. On June 5th, Walcott asked Steelman not to disclose the data to the public unless she cleared it with the city. Steelman declined. In a public statement issued June 7th, city manager Wanda Page said she didn't know about the contamination until Walltown residents brought it to her attention. Even after the Duke results became public and the city hired Mid-Atlantic, Durham officials continued to downplay the researchers' work. Signs at the sampling sites didn't mention the word lead, nor explained why the testing was being done. An insert in city residents' monthly water bills justified the independent soil sampling by noting, quote, the city received a report from a Duke student that warranted follow-up sampling. Again, the word lead was omitted. Over the past 6 weeks, dozens of Durham residents have attended community meetings held at Lion Park and the Holton Career Center, where they have expressed concern over the health of their children who have played in the parks. Other longtime residents, now middle-aged and elderly, are worried they were exposed to the lead as children. So far, Durham County Health Department has not offered to test children's blood for lead. At a previous public meeting, County Health Director Rodney Jenkins told residents to instead contact their primary care doctor. Residents also wonder if private property like yards and gardens near those parks had been contaminated. Now, Mid-Atlantic is expected to issue its final report by August 15th. That's coming right up, isn't it? That document will include additional analysis of each of the hotspots as well as recommendation for short and long-term solutions to address the contamination. The city plans to host 3 in-person community meetings, 1 before the final report is published, 2 at the time, and 3 after its release. Durham officials will publicize the dates of this meeting through neighborhood groups or on the Parks and Rec webpage and through social media. And I will just presume that Indy Week will be sure to list those as well. Lead paint, another article, this by Lisa Sorg. For 83 years, Les Terrasses, a 5,000-square-foot mansion once owned by the tobacco heiress Mary Duke Biddle Trent Siemens, sat perched above Bivens Street in Durham, guarded by an ornate white iron gate and adorned with shutters the color of a Queen Elizabeth rose. On July 14th, the Durham Fire Department burned the house to the ground. Since Siemens' death in 2012, the home had begun to sag and disintegrate. The new owners, who are redeveloping the property for townhouses, donated it to the fire department for a controlled burn, a training exercise. Fire officials say they notified neighbors living within 300 feet of Les Terrasses about the burn. By the time it started, a small crowd had gathered to watch. But the paint chips traveled farther than 300 feet. That morning and into midday, winds blew from the southeast, then the south, then the southwest, gusting at 18 to 20 miles an hour by noon. The wind carried paint chips and ash from the burn northeast, where they landed in the yards and on the decks and patios of several residents along Wells and Carroll Street. A few of those chips, subsequent testing by city contractors revealed, contained lead. Now, Durham is paying to remediate at least 4 properties whose soil is, or presumed to be, contaminated. And I've already mentioned lead is a neurotoxin. There is no safe level of lead, but EPA has established what they call action levels for drinking water, air, soil, and paint in the workplace. The FDA regulates lead in food. Federal government banned lead in paint in 1978, but more than 34 million homes in the United States still have lead paint somewhere in the building. Homes built before 1978 often contain it, particularly on windowsills, doors, cupboards, exteriors, porch, stairs, and metal surfaces. Les Terrasses was built in 1940, property records show, when 69% of all new homes contained lead-based paint, according to the EPA. Chris Iannuzzi, Durham's deputy fire chief of administrative services, said in preparing for the burn, the fire department complied with all state and local guidelines, including those set by the state fire marshal guidelines and the National Fire Protection Association. However, those guidelines, while requiring tests for asbestos, do not mandate the same for lead. When the burn occurred, many Durhamites were already vigilant about lead contamination. High levels had recently been found at those 3 city parks. So when the neighbors found chips of the ash in their yard, they immediately thought of lead. 2 weeks after the burn, officials from the fire department, Department of Health and Human Services, and the County Health Department toured the neighborhood. They saw paint chips in storm gutters and ivy. They spoke with neighbors brandishing plastic baggies of ash and paint. One man in the 1100 block of Wells Street had found ash and chips on the roof of his car just that morning. A woman said he hasn't been outside in 2 weeks. She lives on Wells Street with her husband, as their 2-year-old child rode a plastic pedal car around the house. Their highest lead levels were detected in paint chips in their yard, which lies about 700 feet from the burn. The woman, who is 9-month pregnant, said, "I want my soil and yard cleaned up. I want my kids to be able to run in the yard without worrying about the chips." Someone knocked on the door. It was a representative from the testing company who had arrived to collect the chips. In the tall grass, the family didn't want to risk pulverizing the lead into dust with a mower. The company rep found a white paint chip It lay less than 5 feet from a tricycle. Shortly after the burn, NC Newsline gathered two slats from the home's exterior shutter for testing. Pace Labs, which is EPA certified, sent the results this week. 19,000 parts per million. All children's product and some furniture for adults and children must not contain more than 90 ppm in household paint, according to the Consumer Protection Safety Commission. Newsline shared the results with state environmental and health officials as well as Durham Fire Department. Again, 90 ppm is what's the top allowed. 19,000 is found in some of those paint chips. If you're renovating an older home, it is important to test the paint for lead. Kits are available at hardware stores. Those kits will indicate whether lead is present, but it will not indicate the concentration. Contractors specializing in lead abatement should remove the paint. Since 2018, the Durham Fire has burned 18 homes as part of its training program, according to city records. These exercises help firefighters prepare for many types of blazes, Iannuzzi wrote in an email. Quote, firefighters are not used to the building layout from years of training in the same place like at our facility. They can experience the need to use their senses and equipment to keep their bearings while working in zero visibility environments like the real world. He went on, acquired structure burns also allow firefighters to gain experience with a high degree of safety because the ability for the fire to get out of control is extremely limited. All the backup resources are already in place to prevent the type of extremely hazardous events that can happen in an emergency. Nationwide, a quarter of homes built between 1960 and 1977 contain lead paint. From 1940 to 1959, that figure is 70%. And of the homes burned in Durham, 17 were built before 1978. Three were built from 1890 to 1939, six from 1940 to 59, and when 69, 50, 80% of new homes contained lead paint. Eight were built from 1960 to 77. Most of them on Duke's central campus. By then, the percentage of new homes had fallen to about 24%. Half of all burnt homes were located next to or across the street from occupied houses. Iannuzzi wrote, we have never been contacted about this concern before. When a home is sold, federal law requires the seller to disclose whether it contains lead-contaminated materials. There is an exception for foreclosures. Since Le Terrasses was donated, that law did not apply. Fire officials, quote, have already begun discussions about mitigating potential lead hazards that are not addressed in current control burn guidelines. Research and collaboration with other departments and agencies will guide any local protocol changes, wrote Iannuzzi. It's unclear where the debris from Le Terrasse was disposed. The property owner, West Forest LLC, could not be reached by phone. The material could have been placed in a permitted construction and demolition landfill, even though those facilities are unlined. Construction and demolition landfills, as they're known for short, C&D, are allowed to accept these types of materials, according to a spokesperson for the NC Department of Environmental Quality. Earlier this week, ServPro began flagging parts of residence yard to show where contamination was either found or presumed. As for that family on Wells Street with a toddler, their yard, both back and front, had a half dozen flags. The family's new baby is due in 4 days. Again, from a journal, The Assembly, which is partnering with IndieWeek. The long, long story. I hope I can get through it. If not, I'll continue it in the following week. Orange County has been swept up in the nationwide cultural clashes in education, writes Barry Yeoman. Monique Felder peered through the tall windows, studying the dozens of demonstrators outside Standback Middle School in Hillsboro. Even muffled by the glass, she could hear their agitation. She considered whether they might rush the building, where the Orange County Board of Education was discussing the rise of white nationalism. She hoped the police could contain them if they did. She wondered if she, the school district superintendent, was safe. It was October 2021, a tense time for a district in the maw of the culture war. The previous month, a group that included the Proud Boys, an organization linked to the Capitol insurrection, had assembled with flags and a bullhorn near the entrance to an Orange High School football game. They called for an end to COVID vaccine mandates for students, though none existed, and masking rules, and for the deaths of those who disagreed. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson's office, meanwhile, had singled out Hillsboro's Cedar Ridge High School Library for carrying Maya Kobabe's memoir, Gender Queer. The book, written in graphic novel format, chronicles the author's coming out as non-binary and contains panels depicting adult sex. Robinson, a Republican, had said there's no reason anybody, anywhere in America, should be telling any child about transgenderism, homosexuality, any of that filth. Now, protesters had descended on the board meeting. Several signed up to comment on the math curriculum, but instead used the microphone to claim the board was promoting anti-white racism or seeking to destroy America. Gretchen Schmid, the chair of local Moms for Liberty chapter, signed up to discuss masking policy, then accused the board of working alongside its Antifa allies to silence students and parents who opposed mask mandates. "This, folks, is a manifestation of critical race theory," she said, before officers led her away for veering off topic. Felder wasn't worried about the speeches, the audience outbursts, or even the members of the Proud Boys sitting inside wearing gaiters to cover their faces. She said there's plenty of law enforcement within that auditorium. You'd at least have time to duck and run. But the gathering outside, billed as a rally against filth, felt different. Felder said it was as if hell was unleashed. They were loud, belligerent. Several carried enlargements of the most explicit gender queer illustrations. They demanded the schools quit trying to sexualize children. They called for Felder's resignation, and they whooped as a local Proud Boy emerged from the building and made a speech tying the board's leader to the Marxist Black Lives Matter movement. As Felder took in that scene from inside, someone in the crowd spotted her and pointed. "I'm not a person who frightens easily," said the superintendent, "but I was afraid, and I was afraid for my life." The educational battles that have swept across America have taken deep root in Hillsboro, a county seat better known for colonial-era architecture and literary vibe. Three separate factions, a Venn diagram of overlapping interests and conflicts, have been sparring over what the public schools should deliver and how a board of education should govern. They faced off at the podium, on social media, within the bureaucracy, at the polls and the barricades. They have met in public spectacles and behind closed doors. They have spoken in both blunt and coded words. At stake is the success of 7,000 students attending 7 elementary and 6 secondary schools. Some of the battles in Orange County follow a national script, with an emboldened conservative movement organizing around themes like critical race theory. Education Week reported, "The issues the public brings to school boards are increasingly refracted through the lens of national political discourse. The controversies are now as much about political identity as they are about keeping students safe and engaged." It's not just school board members feeling the heat nationally. Superintendents, too, have become increasingly targeted. In North Carolina, the Republican-sponsored Senate Bill 90 would give parents a tool to force out superintendents who repeatedly violate the, quote, fundamental right to parent. The tension in Orange County doesn't stop with this classic culture war. Board members and their supporters have also split into camps that call themselves progressive and moderate. Their central dispute is how aggressively the board should prioritize the dismantling of systemic discrimination. But that doesn't begin to describe the hostility between those two sides. Orange County may seem like an unlikely setting for such a skirmish, but look at an electoral map of the school district and the polarization makes more sense. Hillsborough, with its Riverwalk and rainbow flags, has grown as a progressive hub since the 2000s when rising home prices in Chapel Hill established it as a relatively affordable alternative, but is a blue hole at the center of an expansive red donut, including rural precincts that voted for President Trump by margins of 3 and 4 to 1. Chapel Hill and Carrboro, also blue, form their own adjacent school district. What appears on the surface like a liberal dominion is actually a place of stark contrasts. Orange County schools have undergone their own demographic change. A student body that was 65% white in 2012 is now less than 50% white. Students speak 40 languages at home. More than 1 in 4 is Hispanic. The number receiving free and reduced-price meals has climbed to almost half. LGBTQ kids are more visible. To understand what this new diversity has meant politically, it's worth detouring back a few years to a moment when America's capacity for coexistence hit rock bottom. During the months surrounding President Trump's 2016 election, Orange County schools mirrored the divided nation. Anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, and white supremacist graffiti appeared in school restrooms. A student told a black teacher that black lives don't matter. Others chanted build a wall and taunted classmates with claims that Trump would deport black and Latino students. Amidst this, a parent named Latondra Strong was dropping off her daughter at Orange High School when she passed a white pickup truck waving a large Confederate flag. Her heart sped up as she flashed back to her Florida childhood. Hers was the first black family in their suburban neighborhood, and drivers with similar flags yelled the N-word through their windows as she walked to the park. "I would be afraid that truck was going to come around and hurt me," she said. Strong was a Republican in 2016, but not particularly political. She believed that if she alerted school authorities to this blind spot, they'd surely order Confederate flags, along with T-shirts, belts, and hats, which she said students wore, off campus. She didn't get the response she expected. Then Board of Education Chair Stephen Halkiotis, a former high school principal in Orange County, said, "When you start banning symbols, you will start attacking freedom of speech. You ban one flag, you're going to have to ban every flag." Strong wrote to other parents. "I can't do it alone," she told them in an email. "I need your help." They began turning out for school board meetings in December 2016 under the umbrella of the Hate Free Schools Coalition, calling for an immediate ban on Confederate emblems. Their numbers grew in the new year. Among them was Hillary McKenzie, a white stay-at-home parent. She had been jolted into action after hearing the language that fueled Trump's election, a racism more overt than the hushed bigotry she had heard as a child in Orange County. She said, "It made me realize, as a young mother, it was not time to sit on the sidelines." McKenzie met Strong and her daughter at a political gathering, listened to their story, and decided to join the effort. Students should be able to go to school without hate symbols around them. Halkiotis wanted to proceed slowly with advice from legal experts on how to balance racial climate and free speech concerns. He said, "Unilateral decisions can be made quickly. A good, solid decision involving many people takes time." Critics called him cowardly and tone-deaf for demanding patience in the face of white supremacy. He said, "It was my time on the cross. I'm serious." In August 2017, the board came around. It voted to ban Confederate flags, swastikas, and Klan symbols. Halkiotis told a reporter, explaining his change of heart, "I respect a flag that is held up as part of one's heritage, but not when it's been co-opted by a militant, racist group." Strong and her allies celebrated. They also noted the board waited until 2 days after a neo-Nazi struck and killed Heather Heyer during the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. McKenzie said, one of the things that became apparent, we needed a new school board because it took them 9 months to do this. McKenzie ran in 2018 on a racial justice platform, and she placed third in a field of eight, enough to secure a seat on the board. The Confederate flag victory offered a tailwind to those eager to confront the obstacles faced by students of color. In 2019, the board acknowledged, quote, the persistent racial intolerance, inequities, and academic disparities in our district. That was the preamble to a new equity policy crafted by a task force that included Strong. The policy called for recruiting a diverse workforce, improving training, and ferreting out barriers that kept certain students from learning. Halkiotis originally opposed it, saying the preamble's mea culpa puts us on shaky legal ground, but the final vote was unanimous. The board also hired Felder as superintendent in 2019. She had been working in Nashville and was impressed by how Orange's equity policy acknowledged the district's own shortcomings. She said, to me, here's a board in the community saying we're not trying to sweep anything under the rug. This was a district that had what I call teeth and muscle by way of policy. She catapulted into the work, and her impact has been significant. The percentage of black high school students in advanced placement and international baccalaureate increased from 18% to 30% over a year. The faculty looks more like the student body. Families who speak limited English at home or don't use email have better access to school communications. Wide demographic gaps persist, and on standardized test scores, only 48% of students achieved grade-level proficiency in 21-22 standards. Statewide, by the way, it's 51%. But Orange ranked number one among North Carolina's 115 districts in terms of how many schools exceeded the state's academic growth targets. And data released in June showed sizable gains in early elementary illiteracy skills, with black students outpacing the average. McKenzie and her allies remained a minority on the board until 2020, when a progressive electoral wave created a 5-2 majority with her as the new chair. The other two members were moderates. From the moment she took the gavel, McKenzie understood the clock was ticking. She said, I don't know how long I would be chair, so I was going to make decisions to get as much done as we possibly could in a short period of time. Much of the board's energy went into COVID policy, which leaned towards caution in health matters. But board members also pushed on equity. They renamed two schools. One had been named for a slaveholder and the other for segregation-era school officials. This cost the progressives some political capital. Even supporters wondered about the timing. Strong said, when Hillary first shared she was going to move forward with renaming, I said, not now. Yes, we should do it, but not now, because the pandemic was still underway. The board also passed detailed guidelines to protect students and employees who are transgender or transitioning. This reflected a recognition that LGBTQ students in Orange County, as elsewhere, face considerable hostility. Teachers told the assembly about students who tear down Gay Straight Alliance posters or belittle their classmates with barbs like, I'm feeling like a sheep today. One high school English teacher described a student who was trying to write about what made him proud of his trans identity and coming up dry. All he could focus on were the hardships. The most contentious of the guidelines notes that some trans students feel endangered or unwelcome at home if they come out. The school principal or their designee should speak with the student first, the policy says, to decide how to involve the student's parents, if at all. Mental health professionals said that discretionary language would protect students' safety. McKenzie, who helped write the guidelines, said that was her intention. "I'm in the business of keeping children alive," she said. Some voters, though, consider the language an encroachment on parents' rights. One of them was a Colorado transplant who soon became the face of conservative opposition. It was affordable land that brought Gretchen Schmidt to Orange County. Back in Colorado, her four children had attended private Waldorf schools, which emphasize arts, the outdoors, and limits technology. But after they relocated in 2020, one of her sons wanted a traditional high school experience with competitive sports. Schmidt and her husband enrolled him in the ninth grade at Orange High. At the Waldorf schools, Schmidt says she met monthly with her children's teachers. They explained what the students were reading and how those stories supported them at their developmental stage. Schmidt still wanted to know what her son would be studying. As she looked online for the curriculum, she stumbled on conservative websites from other states where parents had scoured their children's reading list. Schmidt recalled they identified the themes that kept coming up, and they were cannibalism, church is bad, family is bad, scary white people. Schmidt's alarm mounted the following year when she learned her son's English class was reading Like Water for Chocolate aloud. Laura Esquivel's novel follows a Mexican woman whose cooking transmits powerful emotions, including sadness and lust. The tale has magical realism, political metaphor, evocative food writing, and extramarital sex. Schmidt said a totally inappropriate book. "We teach our family about the importance of family, and we follow God's plan for the family, and that is a very sacred emphasis on the power of procreation. That means celibacy until marriage," and Schmidt felt the book was at odds with that teaching. "We don't need extra kindling to put on what's already really strong for a teenager." Schmidt considered this grooming, one example of public school overreach. She also disapproved of mandatory COVID testing and on-field masking for unvaccinated student-athletes. Waldorf schools tend to draw vaccine-averse families like hers. And she considered the transgender guidelines anti-family because they give schools leeway about notifying parents. She had already started organizing a chapter of Moms for Liberty, a self-described parental rights group that originated in Florida. The organization, known as for its confrontational tactics, grew rapidly during the pandemic. She set out to spread the word. Facebook reached a limited audience, so Schmidt began approaching parents as they waited to pick up their children after school. One afternoon, she put on a purple T-shirt from a charity race, then walked the car line at an elementary school that serves many immigrant families. She handed out a QR code for a conservative website, promising parents they'd learn about library and classroom materials, test scores, and teacher attrition. McKenzie was there picking up her child. She spotted Smith, quote, "looking like a nice white lady, looking like a teacher, and something about it just made me so angry." That board member jumped out of the car, leaving her husband to wait for the child. She followed close behind the Moms for Liberty chair. "It's propaganda," she shouted to the drivers. "Call the school board if you have questions." McKenzie threatened to call the police if Schmidt held up the line. "How does it feel to spread lies, Gretchen?" she asked. "Why are you so against gay kids?" "Why do you want to sexualize children?" Schmidt shot back. "Why are you a fascist, Gretchen?" the board member later asked, as part of the exchange that Smith recorded and conservative activists shared online. In retrospect, McKenzie said she probably should have walked away, but she said she stands by her choice of words. She is an alt-right conservative and spreading misinformation. To me, that falls pretty closely in the line of fascism. Schmidt's Moms for Liberty chapter joined a matrix of groups organizing around district policies, including the Orange County Republican Party, which urged the board's opponent to sign up for public comments to push back on their equity agenda. They already had. At a September 2021 meeting, Behrens called board members dictators and compared mask mandates to the Trail of Tears. They chastised the board for displaying a terrorist, meaning Black Lives Matter, flag. One paraphrased the Book of Matthew, telling members to tie millstones around your neck and throw yourself into the sea before you mess with these kids. Conservatives were also active online, describing the transgender guidelines as parental subversion and suggesting that the next teachers will help students get secret piercings and change their religions. The APEC-based Education First Alliance, which sponsored the rally against filth, claimed in a video that Antifa was informing the school board and that McKenzie supported indoctrinating kids in gender fluidity. When Orange County Schools announced an affinity space where Black employees could meet and support one another following some traumatic national headlines, the Virginia-based Parents Defending Education filed a civil rights complaint with the U.S. Department of Education. The complaint, which the department did not take up, alleged the district was promoting, quote, explicit racial segregation. Both McKenzie and Vice Chair Brenda Stevens said they received threats to their safety, and in McKenzie's case, death threats. This fits what the U.S. Department of Justice described in 2021 as a, quote, disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence against school board members and school personnel nationally. McKenzie bought a home security system. Stevens, a Black retired librarian who served 20 years on the board, obtained weapons training and a concealed carry permit. She said, I remember someone saying, I know where you live. I said publicly, you set the foot on my property and you might meet your maker, because I'm not going to be harassed and intimidated. This isn't the 40s, 50s, and 60s. They've been doing it to Black people for years. 3 days before the rally against filth, in October 2021, a parent named Jackie Barker filed a complaint seeking the removal of Gender Queer and two other books from Cedar Ridge High School Library. Barker, who had a child at Cedar Ridge, said she had watched a video of a school board meeting from another district where genderqueer was discussed. It was the most challenged book in a year that such challenges increased fourfold, according to the American Library Association. The book contains several references to masturbation and 5 pages depicting frontal nudity or sex. On the most explicit page, the author and a partner, both young adults, awkwardly try to use a dildo for oral sex before abandoning the effort. Barker said she wanted to see if the parents' concerns were legitimate, so she borrowed the book from the public library. The LGBTQ characters don't bother her, she said, but the graphic content did. Quote, these types of stories are over-sexualizing our youth and indoctrinating them with grotesque sexual encounters, she wrote in her complaint. She found the author's support for pediatric gender-affirming care, including medications to delay puberty, offensive. She found sympathy within Cedar Ridge. In a conversation she recorded, then Principal Carlos Ramirez told Barker he had not read all of Gender Queer, but the pages he had viewed online surprised him. He had told her, our mouths kind of fell open. How is it a National Library Association, where librarians across the country, really across the globe, buy books from their recommendation list? How did they not put a warning asterisk or something? Ramirez said the comment reflected his opinion rather than school policy. 2 review committees, once of which included Ramirez, later read the full book and recommended keeping it. So did Felder, the superintendent. The school board made the final call during a Zoom meeting in January 2022. Members described genderqueer as more complex than opponents depicted. The sexual sequences were a small slice of the author's journey from confusion to self-respect. Carrie Doyle, McKenzie's successor as chair and the progressive, said, I was also deeply touched by the loving and supportive family and community that helped Maya Kobabe. My hope is for our community to be equally supportive of our LGBTQ students, staff, and families. McKenzie noted the high suicidality rate amongst transgender and non-binary youth. Her motion to retain the book indefinitely and district-wide passed 7-0. The board then voted to keep the other two books, which were contested for their descriptions of sex and abuse. Jonathan Evanson's Lawn Boy, about a young landscaper trying to break out of poverty, and Ashley Hope Perez, Out of Darkness, about an interracial romance during the lead-up to a fatal school explosion in Texas in the 1930s. Each vote was unanimous, a display of common ground by a politically divided board. Member Bonnie Hauser, a moderate, said, "My mother was an Auschwitz survivor, so book banning has real meaning." By then, the 2022 election and the next skirmish was brewing over issues more mundane but not less contentious. All right, at this point in this long article, I'm about halfway through it, I'm going to cut off my reading of it, but I intend fully to complete the article in our next presentation to you folks on Indie Week. One of the reasons is it's too long to allow for other articles, and there's a full folder today, but also because it seems to be so well written. To my mind, this is John Feddersen speaking, not Reader Service or anybody else. The author provides, humanizes all sides of these controversies, at least the ones that are mentioned. In other words, not centrism, but explains motivations in a way that seems to me to say that they understand how there can be disagreements. Whether or not the disagreements are violent is another story. But I respect this kind of journalism. It takes a longer article than to toss out some labels and let it go at that. And I think that seems to indicate a new change in direction for Indie Week. So that's a little speech making on my part. I don't like looking at some of the name calling. Some of it's appropriate, depending on what it is. So I will bring that article back and I'll next broadcast. And so that folks who are really interested and can't or don't want to read it on the Indie Week website will be able to listen to that and this broadcast to hear the entire thing. So I'm going to move to an op-ed by Paul Scott. And let's see, who is Paul Scott? Paul Scott is an activist based in Durham, minister Paul Scott. And it's called The Glorification of Gang Life. Professor John Diop Williams, chair of African American Studies Department at Marcus Garvey University, was in the middle of giving what he thought was a powerful lecture on black-on-black violence to a predominantly white middle-class audience when he noticed most of the crowd members were either checking their emails or nodding off. Frustrated, he randomly yelled out, "I've never been a stranger to a homicide. My city's full of gangbangers and drive-bys." From that point on, the suddenly attentive audience hung on every word he spoke, until he ended his lecture with an impromptu rendition of All Eyes on Me. Now, while this story is just allegorical, courtesy of watching too many late-night Boondocks episodes, the scenario is familiar to many African-American activists working to stop gun violence in our cities. Back in 1959, there was a tearjerker of a movie called Imitation of Life, about a light-skinned black woman who gained entry into high society by passing for white. However, for the last 30 years, a surefire way to win the attention of Middle America, if you are an African-American male, is to be an imitator of thug life, a term popularized by the late rapper Tupac Shakur. Recently, I attended a Stop the Violence meeting in Durham and engaged in what I hoped would be a deep conversation with an older white gentleman about a major problem facing our city. As I told him about the books I had read about violence in the African-American community from authors such as Amos Wilson and Joyce DeGray, he wasn't overly enthused. His only response was, "Yeah, I just finished reading The Hate U Give, THUG, a novel by Angie Thomas." Like my character, Professor Williams, this wasn't the first time I've tried to speak to white folks on gun violence, only to have my rising crescendo of black analysis deflated by the condescending question, "So what's it like growing up in the hood?" The reality is, despite what you see in the movies, most black men's first experience with gang life comes courtesy of Hollywood or the music industry, not what we grew up seeing outside our front doors every day. While America became infatuated with the gangsta lifestyle in the early 90s, as the popularity of groups like NWA began to capture the imagination of white Americans who vicariously lived the lives of L.A. gang members through videos on Yo! MTV Raps. In literary circles, books such as Monster by Cody Scott, who writes under the name Sangeeka Shakur, and Dr. Michael Eric Dyson's Between God and Gangster Rap made hood stories become the Bibles of the black experience. It's troubling that places like Durham have turned the gangsta lifestyle into public policy, as the idea that in order to reach black youth, you have to have shot somebody in a past life becomes a dream that million-dollar grants are made of. Although well-funded groups like Bull City United and others that use former gang members to help steer young men away from the vicious cycle of street violence may be well-intentioned, it gets problematic when they become replacements for community members who could offer an African-centered, scholarly critique of systemic white supremacy as the root cause of socio and economic factors that lead to criminal behavior and who do not pander to white liberal guilt. For those of us engaged in black radical politics, the degree of separation is not wide enough for us to view the street cats as the proverbial others. They are us, and we are them. As I walk through Durham neighborhoods every evening, passing out free black cultural books and giving impromptu history lectures to young black men, I don't see them as gangbangers. I view them as my brothers in the struggle. As the scholar and writer Dr. Dyson once reminded the audience at a lecture he gave at NC Central many years ago, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Tupac Shakur, and the notorious B.I.G. all suffered the same fate. Durham, of course, has a history of black middle-class success. Dr. E. Franklin Frazier, in his book, Black Bourgeoisie, wrote in 1957 that at one point the Bull City, quote, regarded as the capital of the black bourgeois. But a get-this-money-by-any-means-necessary attitude has resulted in a phenomenon that could only exist in a town with this kind of economic legacy. In Durham, this economic ideology has led to a gangsterized version of the lumpen bourgeoisie, which embraces middle-class money but rejects its traditional code of ethics. What makes members of this class problematic to a race suffering under systemic white supremacy is they bypass revolutionary or even reformist ideology and immediately join the ranks of reactionary politics, whether via the black market economy or grants from the nonprofit industrial complex. Instead of fighting the powers that be, they become part of them. Although there is much said about defunding the police, there is relative silence when it comes to defunding the nonprofit industrial complex. in parentheses, he says, read, the revolution will not be funded by Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, for arguments for the exception. Well-intentioned nonprofits bankroll negative stereotypes of black men as gangsters instead of functioning as deterrents to crime. They aid in portraying that lifestyle as a necessary step to upward socioeconomic and political mobility. This is most pronounced during election season when gangsterism is used for political leverage. What is sold to politicians and suburbanites is a false ideology known as street knowledge, or what Dr. Bobby Wright, in his book of essays, The Psychopathic Racial Personality, called street sense, which propagates the idea there is a sacred code of conduct that only gives someone who has spent at least 7 years behind bars the street cred to inspire young black men to turn away from a life of crime. In these scenarios, street knowledge requires no socio-political analysis, just a long rep sheet. We will never stop the gun violence in the community with politicians and their nonprofit industrial complex homies promoting the nihilist idea that criminal behavior is some sort of rite of passage for young black men. Unfortunately, in order to even enter into the marketplace ideas, you have to play the role of a 90s wannabe gangster rapper. To borrow from the poet Paul Lawrence Dunbar, as black men of 2023, we wear the mask that grimaces and lies. Three small articles left to next week, hopefully, are a review of Charlie Tape, and that is a record coming out with a 4.5-star review by Charlie Smarts and DJ 3 Digits, Charlie Tape, and an article about the downtown Chapel Hill Garden Spot that helps small businesses grow. That's Garden Spot on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Well, here comes our ensemble, and I've had to curtail this fairly rich offering this week from our publication. And we hope that you'll come back next week. Remember, there's a whole log of years and years of Indie Week and Independence online in our podcast section. And you can look for that as you please. Meanwhile, now John Federson saying so long for Indie Week this week. And we will be back with our next issue in 1 week's time. For the North Carolina Reading Service, thanks for listening.